World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation in behalf of Admiral distributors and dealers all over America and in many foreign lands. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers in our own country, CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Douglas Edwards.
The world heard indirectly from Hitler for the first time in 17 weeks today. He didn't broadcast, but he issued a proclamation containing all the old Nazi diatribes and claims that victory for Germany is certain, with the preservation of Germans of first importance. At the same time, the German Volkssturm, the People's Army, swore allegiance to the Führer and pledged unconditional resistance to the Allies. Reichsminister Goebbels spoke at the ceremonies and said regiments of the People's Army would be used to bolster any critical section of the front. On the battlefields, American troops are making fresh gains in the fight for Metz. The Russians are reported to have crossed the Danube near Budapest, and the Japs have taken another beating in the trying to reinforce Leyte. And now, news sent direct from overseas. Admiral takes you to CBS Paris. Larry Lesser reporting.
The Battle of Lorraine flamed more fiercely, and the Germans hurled tanks at General Patton's doughboys for the first time since the Third Army's autumn offensive began. Surging across Patton's countryside, white with snow, the German tanks pounded at the American bridgehead over the swift-flowing Moselle River north of Metz. The doughboys were forced to withdraw almost 2 miles before the German pressure was spent. But on the southern side of Metz, the American 4th Armored Division smashed 2 small German counterattacks, and last resort had the American tanks pursuing the withdrawing Germans. Apparently, the small counterattacks on the southern flank of Patton's drive to encircle Metz were a German endeavor to protect the rest of their forces now retreating into the protection of the old French Maginot Line. Patton's drive now has forged an arc two-thirds of the way around the fortress city of Metz. The powerful German counterattack with tanks came about 5 miles south of the German frontier, where it joins with Luxembourg. All the fighting on the Third Army front today pointed to the fact that German resistance is stiffening as the Third Army doughboys approach the first of the defenses of Germany in the Lorraine sector, those bleak high ridges where the concrete fortresses of the Maginot Line are concealed. This evening, at the old Paris City Hall, which has played such a conspicuous part in French revolutions, I watched Prime Minister Churchill of Britain address the Paris citizens who liberated their city. Churchill urged the Paris Committee to seek stability for France, and he called upon them to rally around General de Gaulle. The British Prime Minister's speech was delivered in Churchillian French. In return, the Paris Liberation Committee made Churchill an honorary citizen of Paris, and they presented him with a German bayonet and a swastika banner that once hung over the Paris police headquarters. It was a simple, touching ceremony, and Churchill's speech in French won him sparkling applause, especially from his wife and his daughter Mary, who also attended. This is Larry Lesser returning you now to Admiral in New York.
And now for news on the situation in the German industrial machine at the moment, Admiral takes you to CBS London, Eric Severod reporting.
France is now admitted to the European Advisory Commission, and so again the whole question of what to do with Germany is a number one story in England. All the political press today devotes columns to the problem. It is a favorite topic of the letters by all manner of citizens, from day laborers to members of parliament. Very much is still indefinite and undecided. But for the immediate job of handling Germany's economy after Victory Day, schemes in great detail are making ready here. For months here, experts have been studying every possible scrap of information on German industries, raw materials, and her skilled and unskilled labor resources. Some decisions have already been made. For one thing, there will be no wholesale dumping of German goods as occurred after the last war. There will be mobilization of all German men and women capable of work. They will be registered as everyone is today in Britain. German men from 16 to about 60 and all women up to 45 or 50 who have no children will be put to work either inside Germany or in other areas wrecked by the German armies. Poland and Western Russia will probably have priority on German labor. It is believed here, contrary to many reports, that the Russians do not wish many millions of laborers inside their country. What they want is about 1.5 million skilled workers and no more. What reserves of locomotives, trucks, and machine tools are found will go to countries who lost these things to the Germans. Germany's industries, of course, will come under Allied control. So will her exports. And there is a plan to have Allied customs officers stationed at every port and frontier post to check everything sent into Germany. Some things will be admitted only on a special license, under very strict quotas. And that would include anything such as oil, rubber, copper, anything which could possibly be used for dangerous purposes. I return you now to Admiral.
More news in just a moment, but first here's Warren Sweeney with a message from Admiral Corporation.
Here is a post-war promise from Admiral. You can expect many new and exciting things in radios and radio phonographs with automatic record changers in FM and in television. And many of them will originate with the designers and engineers who have made Admiral Radio America's smart set. Admiral's experience in development and production enable them to quickly convert Admiral factories to the 100% war production of radio, radar, and communications equipment. When peace comes, Admiral can just as rapidly reconvert to civilian production. All the knowledge and methods gained during the war can be usefully applied to the building of better Admiral radios for you. The Admiral line of radios will be complete. There'll be bantams and portables, AC, DC, battery, farm sets, table models, straight consoles, consoles with automatic record changers, and beautifully authentic period reproductions, all with automatic record changers. Yes, in your post-war Admiral radio, there'll be automatic tuning, Magna band shortwave, foolproof automatic record changers with slide away, FM, and in some models, television. In fact, there'll be the best of everything to provide better reception and more listening pleasure for you. It's a post-war promise from Admiral. Now here once again is Douglas Edwards.
For a summary of activity in the Pacific and an interview with the commanding general, 7th Air Force, Admiral takes you to CBS Pearl Harbor. Webley Edwards reporting.
Attention is still focused on the seas in the vicinity of the central Philippines, where Jap convoys have attempted reinforcement of troops on Leyte Island. There are no further details at the moment on the Third Fleet's smashing destruction of a Jap 10-ship convoy off Ormoc Bay. It's believed Third Fleet carrier forces are still operating in the vicinity. 1 year ago today, bombers of the 7th Air Force left a tiny coral atoll. They were heading for Tarawa, a name soon to be famous for its bitter fighting. Tarawa kicked off the big push by Admiral Nimitz across the Pacific. The 7th Air Force did the Army's fine part in its pinpoint bombing before the invasion. And now, 12 months later, they are advanced more than 3,000 miles, based in the Marianas. Their bombing of the Bonians, only 527 miles from Tokyo and other targets, is a highly important right flank action in Nimitz's aid to the MacArthur invasion. On this important day in its history, we have the 7th Air Force's commanding general, Major General Robert W. Douglas, Jr., as our guest. The 7th has gone a long way, General.
Yes. Prior to a year ago tomorrow, the 7th Air Force was primarily a defensive organization, defending the Hawaiian Islands, but planning for future offensive operations. That planning took tangible shape with the air attack on Tarawa on November the 13th, 1943, and has never let up since. After the Gilberts, we concentrated on the Marshalls, paving the way for the invasion of Kwajalein. Other Marshall Islands were bombed so effectively that invasion was unnecessary. Then came the Carolines and regular bombing trips to Truk. In June, when United States amphibious forces invaded the Marianas, it was estimated that 95,000 Jap troops had been bypassed, sealed off from supplies or hope of rescue.
It's been a year of great extremes and contrast, General.
In the largest theater of war, 16 million square miles, the targets are the smallest. Pinpoint islands, whose entire area are, in many instances, smaller than single factories in Germany. There is no margin for error. On these small islands, the enemy could concentrate his flak against our planes. At first, our bombers slew missions averaging 2,400 miles, four times the distance from London to Berlin. Recently, our missions have been shorter, and our fighters have been used for short-range bombing and rocket flying as low-flying artillery to support our ground troops.
The men of the 7th Air Force have met some unusual conditions during this year, General Douglas.
Yes, one Liberator came in on only one of its four engines and landed without mishap. They tossed out everything they could find loose to lighten their load. One man even tossed overboard his shoes and came in barefooted. They developed a Tinian, an unusual method of baiting Jap machine gunners. One plane would show itself at low level, while others would spot and destroy the NIP firing position. One of our pilots, with his braking system shut out, was the first to use parachutes to slow up his landing on a short runway. The 7th Air Force transport squadrons have flown the first transport planes into newly won islands from Tarawa to the Palaus. Aviation engineers, not far behind assault troops, have completed airstrips and had them in operating condition within a week after D-Day. It has taken sturdy men to do this work.
Today marks the first year of the advance by air attack from Tarawa to the Bonins, General. May we suggest a slogan for the 7th? From Tarawa to Tokyo. And thank you, sir. Major General Robert W. Douglas, Commanding General, 7th Air Force, has been our guest speaking from Fleet Headquarters, Pearl Harbor. This is Webley Edwards returning you to Admiral in New York.
It's still a slow and tough battle on the Italian front. For a direct report, Admiral takes you to CBS Rome, Farnsworth Fowle reporting.
Except for fierce fighting to drive the Germans from the outskirts of Forlì, yesterday was another day of patrolling on the front. Today, Liberator bombers renewed their attack on the railway line through the Brenner Pass. The anniversary of the Soviet Revolution was celebrated again this noon when the working men of Rome had a Sunday holiday and were able to attend. It was the biggest demonstration yet held in liberated Italy. From various quarters of the city, groups of men and women marched through the streets and up to the Palatine Hill. On that cold, windswept hilltop, among the ruins of the palaces of the Caesars, they stood for 2 hours, an orderly crowd estimated at 20,000 people. They sang the Internationale and Bandiera Rossa. Loudspeakers amplified the voices of the leaders of the two left-wing parties that had organized the meeting. Loudspeakers amplified the voices of the leaders of the two left-wing parties that had organized the meeting. Palmiro Togliatti spoke for the communists, Pietro Nenni for the socialists. They both said in almost identical words that the communist and socialist parties would remain united until Italy is liberated and the republic has been achieved. And that, even more than the size of the meeting, made it a turning point in local politics, because the present Italian government under Bonomi is held together by an agreement not to campaign for or against the monarchy. The six parties that formed the government first got together here in Rome before the fall of Mussolini a year ago in July. They called themselves the Committee of National Liberation and worked underground against the Duce's faltering regime. A similar committee was formed in Naples and reinforced by Italian political exiles who returned after we'd driven the Germans north of the city. This Committee of Liberation for many months refused to support the Badoglio government because it meant cooperating with King Victor Emmanuel, whom they considered almost as bad as Mussolini. When Togliatti, the communist leader, arrived from Moscow 7 months ago, he urged his left-wing comrades to postpone the question of the monarchy and enter the Badoglio government. Victor Emmanuel retired in favor of his son Umberto, who became lieutenant general. And a couple of months later, when Rome was liberated, Badoglio was replaced as prime minister by Bonomi, who had headed the original Committee of Liberation here in Rome. Things have changed during the past 4 months. The liberation of northern Italy, which seemed so near, turns out to be a long and difficult job for the Allied armies. Until the Allied armies complete the job and move on, the Italian government has only the leftovers of real political authority. Without too much noise, the monarchy is winning more and more support from conservative elements. The army is being built up again as a monarchist stronghold. The left-wing parties are increasingly uneasy about a postponement of discussion, which is working out in favor of the monarchy. The fact that the communist leader, Togliatti, who was chiefly responsible for the political coup 7 months ago, spoke openly in favor of a republic today, shows that the agreement holding the parties of left and right together is wearing very thin. Now back to Admiral in New York.
And here with us in our New York studio for a summary of the military situation on the Eastern Fronts is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
Considerable speculation in military circles has been aroused by the sudden German decision to declare the Gulf of Bothnia and the greater part of the Baltic Sea to be a war zone in which any shipping may be subject to be destroyed without warning. The Germans must have felt they had good and sufficient military reasons for so drastic a step, reasons which outweighed its political disadvantages. These disadvantages have been immediately made manifest in the sharply unfavorable reaction of the Swedish government. The Germans can't afford to make an enemy of Sweden at this juncture, for the Swedish fleet is almost a match for the German Baltic fleet, and the Swedish Air Force is well-equipped and well-trained. The risk which the Germans took in their war zone declaration is primarily a risk that Sweden might regard it as a hostile act in itself, or that incidents might occur arising from it which would bring about armed resistance by the Swedish Navy and Air Force. Why did the Germans take this risk? It could only have been in order to give their own naval and air forces greater freedom of action in the Baltic, to enable them to establish better control of movements in Baltic waters. Since the Germans are in no position to undertake a Baltic offensive, their basic purpose must be of a defensive character. Against what sort of threat do they seek to defend themselves? When we have carried our analysis this far, we begin to take a good deal of interest in the writer's report from Moscow that the Soviet Union is about to startle the world by a vast amphibious operation or series of operations against the coastal regions of Germany. The Baltic coast of Germany has less in the way of fixed defenses than the North Sea coast by a good deal, because up to this time the Germans have felt secure in their control of the Baltic Sea. The operations of their armies deprived the Russians from the autumn of 1941 onward until this summer of all access to the Baltic coast. But now the Russians have many ports on the Baltic. They have full control of the Finnish coast, of Estonia, including the Estonian Islands, except one small German strong point. They still hold Riga, and they are in course of wiping out a German force which is defending the ports of Windau and Liebau on the coast of Latvia. The strength of the Russian Baltic fleet is unknown, but it may well be strong enough to deal with what is left of the German surface navy. Hence, the best naval weapon left to the Germans may be the submarine. It's altogether possible that the German war zone proclamation is intended to cover the full-scale, unrestricted use of German U-boats against Russian shipping in the eastern Baltic, with allowances for errors which, in the fogs and mist of that region, might bring a German torpedo crashing into the side of a Swedish ship. If the Germans suspect that the Russians are really preparing an amphibious descent on the German coast, they'd be willing to take desperate measures indeed to prevent it, for such a Russian landing might bring a Russian army suddenly to a point scarcely 100 miles from Berlin and impose on the German high command the need for finding a new army of defense when its resources are already strained to their uttermost limit. Now here again is Douglas Edwards.
And for news on the home front and an interview with the general commanding the 1st Marine Division in the Peleliu assault, Admiral takes you to CBS Washington, Don Pryor reporting.
General William H. Rupertus has 3 major campaigns in the Pacific to his credit, so I think he can be accepted as an authority on the war against the Japanese. He was assistant division commander of the 1st Marine Division at Guadalcanal. He was in charge of the landing operations at Tulangi, Kavutu, and Tanambogo. He commanded the 1st Division at Cape Gloucester, and he's just returned from leading the 1st Division in the assault on Peleliu. General, which do you consider the toughest of these operations?
I don't believe there's any measure of comparison. Each campaign was against the same fanatically determined enemy, and each had its own problems of weather, terrain, and distribution of enemy strength. All the campaigns against the Japanese have been hard, bitterly contested operations that have demanded the utmost of every man engaged in them. I know that every man in every branch of the military service fighting in the Pacific is willingly giving everything he has to achieve a common goal, the complete defeat of the Japanese enemy. If that aim is to be reached, the people back home, each related in blood to a fighting man, must contribute in the same measure. The war against the Japanese is a very personal war. Every bomb and every bullet sounds as though it is meant for you in person. Much of the fighting is at the closest quarters. You are the man that psyche-crazed warrior is charging at as he runs screaming toward your lines. You are the man that gleaming samurai sword is going to cut through if you don't strike first. That's just what we've been doing out there, striking first and striking hard.
Well, it seems to have been working pretty well, General. We've gone a long way in the Pacific in the last 2 years. Do you think we're close to our goal of complete defeat of the Japanese?
The hardest part of the war lies ahead of us. As we get closer to the Japanese homeland, the Japanese determination and fanaticism becomes even greater. Their military strength also increases as we get closer to its source. This is certainly no time to sit back and contemplate our past successes. Rather, we should consider the tremendous task that lies ahead and mentally resolve to match in willing personal contribution, inspired by love of country, the fanatic devotion to the emperor that spurs the Japanese.
Well, Friday was the 169th anniversary of the founding of the United States Marine Corps, General. What do you think the 170th year holds for the Corps?
I think it will probably be one of the fightingest years in our fighting history. We Marines are naturally proud of our past achievements, and as a Marine, I can assure the people of the United States that every man in the Corps will be doing everything he can to sustain our record and justify the motto of the Marine Corps, Semper Fidelis, always faithful.
Thank you, General, and I'm sure that every Marine will. The news from Washington today is mostly rumor and speculation. It's not unusual for Washington, of course, but it's a bit more lively now that Mr. Roosevelt is about to embark on his fourth term as president. Most of the speculation deals with possible shifts in the New Deal high command. For what it's worth, the dopesters are betting now on Fred Vinson for Justice Byrne's job as director of war mobilization or assistant president. His present job is director of economic stabilization. As for the cabinet, there's nothing very authoritative, but there's some speculation, which is probably as much wishful as informed, as to whether President Roosevelt will accept Madam Perkins' standing resignation and appoint a man to head the Department of Labor. And Secretary Hull is a subject of considerable rumor, too. He's a most thoroughly respected member of the cabinet, but his health may not permit him to serve very much longer, and for some time there's been persistent rumor that he might resign. But there's nothing authoritative on that, and you can take your choice of whatever rumors you happen to hear. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
In Paris a few minutes ago, Prime Minister Churchill told a cheering crowd that Britain wants a powerful and well-equipped French army as soon as possible to aid in re-establishing the stability of Europe and hopes that the French will maintain internal solidarity and stability under General Charles de Gaulle's government. And now once again, here is Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral.
Post-war, the dual temp by Admiral will be the successor to the conventional type of refrigerator. Sounds like a pretty strong statement, doesn't it? But you'll get so much more on your Admiral Dual Temp than in any other refrigerator. Let me give you five great features that you'll find only in a Dual Temp. First, there'll never be any regular messy job of defrosting in the Dual Temp because there are no coils to defrost. Second, you'll get purified, moist cold in a regular food storage compartment. This means you'll never have to use covered dishes for foods. Third, a new, improved Sterilamp will utilize ultraviolet rays to kill germs, retard mold, and aid in eliminating offensive odors. Fourth, have you ever known anyone whose refrigerator was large enough? Well, the storage room for food in the Admiral Dual Temp will be much larger because of the absence of the space-stealing coils. And fifth, you'll really be thrilled with the big built-in home freezer in the post-war Admiral Dual Temp. It will quick freeze foods or store frozen foods for months. It's really a separate refrigerator built right into the Dual Temp. Yes, the electric refrigerator sensation of the post-war world is going to be Dual Temp, and only Admiral can build a Dual Temp.